Okay, we are recording. I have no banter because this week has been terrible.
Oh, so this week we gotta girl quick.
Yeah, this week's been terrible. I'm not gonna say it on here because it's too much. Anyway,
So let's tell stories to each other
yeah,
instead
what
and
story?
ignore the world we live in.
I had a mental breakdown many a time this week. Well, who's going first today?
All right, I don't know how you find so many stories to tell, like the victim's perspective. It's a talent.
Well, I just look for a lot of information.
That's fair.
But sometimes they don't really know anything about the victim,
Well,
so you
that's usually
can't.
my problem, because sometimes I feel bad about telling the story about these bad people, but.
Well, most of my stories have been about, like, the bad guy and not, like, the person that was killed.
Yeah.
You know?
But you, I don't think I've ever told one that's just the victim's side and then they get killed, but you definitely have done more than one.
Well, it's because I listen to a lot of stuff and I've seen a lot of shows where they like don't tell you anything about the victim and it's all just revolving
Oh,
around the
yeah.
killer and I'm just like I think I end up looking for stories that
I at
like
least try to find names of people.
No, yeah, but I think I end up looking without thinking about it for stories that tell you more about the victim. And then I find those more interesting because they're different from what I normally see. So I think that's how I see it, how I find different stuff.
That's fair. Okay. So my story today is about Rudy Blattel. Blattel? I'm thinking it's Blattel because I assume it's said in a lazy American format. It's Bladel.
Bladel sounds familiar to me.
Blattel. My singular source is Wikipedia because I got tired of researching. He's like on other things, but they all said the same
Yeah,
stuff.
I hate when
So
that happens.
I said, screw it, we're just gonna use the one because it's at least I don't like using newspaper articles for like my entirety of my research because they're so disjointed because they're trying to tell a narrative to keep people engaged rather than inform you.
Yeah.
And I'm not a fan when I'm trying to research. But they usually have like the better quotes in them. Anyway. So Rudy Blattel was born in 1932 in Chicago, Illinois. His father, Holgar, worked for the Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific Railroad Company, which is that's one railroad company, has a long name.
Yeah.
This is usually known as Rock Island because that's the original
Okay.
line. So after graduating high school in 1951, Rudy became a firefighter. Firefighter. Fireman, I'm sorry.
Same
For,
thing.
no, it's not. It becomes an issue later.
Oh,
He is
okay.
not fighting fires. He's not putting out fires in a burned down house. He is a fireman for a locomotive. So he's like the one who is maintaining the temperature slash fuel situation, I believe.
Okay.
I didn't get a great explanation from the internet. Either way, he's a fireman for the Rock Island Railroad. Originally, I thought he was a firefighter, and that's why I wrote that in my notes.
Yeah.
And then I had like a long con there's a big long confusion, and I had to like write it out in my notes in case I forgot to tell it. Anyway, so he's a fireman for the Rock Island Railroad. He later enlists in the army as a military engineer and serves in Korea. While in Korea, he worked as a hostler, which is someone who takes care of locomotives in a roundhouse, and the roundhouse was sometimes under enemy fire. During this time, he claimed that the military tested his IQ, and I do believe that was something that was happening. Like, they just did that as part of their like general exams. And that his IQ was 145, which at the time would put him in the top 2.2% of people who'd ever been tested. The scale changes over time, so that's why it's
Yeah.
noteworthy to say at the time he took the test.
I don't even know what a high IQ is. Like, I literally don't know how that scale works at all. I know nothing about it.
It's just
Like, I don't
somebody
know.
made it up,
I
like any other
know. I
test.
know, but like I don't know like what number qualifies someone as having a high IQ. You know what I mean?
145 is considered very superior intelligence.
Eh.
That's the highest ranking you can get.
See
Is
now,
very superior
I
intelligence.
just don't believe that.
We don't need to get into IQs and why
We
they're all made
can.
up. I don't know enough about them to get into them.
No, I just think whenever somebody's like saying how smart they are to you, it just makes them look so dumb to me.
I think when that's the number, that's how they start that conversation, it says a certain thing about them as
a person. Yeah, if you go, well, did you know that I actually tested blah, 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 or this is what I got on my ACT? And I'm like, how, you're 30-something years old.
Are we still riding that high?
I'm sorry, what are you talking about right now?
Anyway, so after returning from war, Bladel got into a motorcycle accident, which caused an injury. No, it was an injury that permanently altered his posture and gait.
Oh, okay.
So he just now, like, distinctively moves.
Okay. Evidence later.
Yeah, exactly. So he returned to being a fireman for the Rock Island Railroad, rose through the company ranks. And this is when I have my long thing where I'm very, very confused, because at first I thought they meant he was a firefighter in Rock Island, Illinois.
Okay.
Which is like a town.
Yeah.
And then I was like, no, this doesn't make sense. Because something says later, it's like he's been working for the train for years, but there hasn't been enough time for him to be working for the train for years if he's doing that. And the timeline about Korea was true. So I was like, okay, maybe he was working as a firefighter for the railroad, which is when I was like, hold on, maybe fireman means something different. Because I already had to look up that other word for like the locomotive handler.
Yeah.
I was like, maybe it's more fancy railroad lingo that no one else knows. It was that. So he's been working for the Rock Island Railroad line the entire time, not the Rock Island city.
Yeah.
So it's the same line that his dad was, like, worked for. Anyway, that's all an important thing to have figured out, because in 1959, the New York Central Railroad moves The New York Central Railroad moved from Michigan to Indiana and did not offer to move most of the old employees to the new location, instead opting to hire locals. This does mean at some point he switched who he's working for, because the New York Central Railroad line never owned or was, like, specifically associated with the Rock Island line. So he switched lines, and I think it's because he's connected to this union. So he's not one of the firemen who gets to move. He loses his job when this switches, when the switch happens. And so he becomes very angry with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Firemen, which is a union that he says sold out by allowing this to happen, allowing all these people to be left behind. So I assume he's always been with this union, and that's why he's mad at it. It's not that he's mad at the railroad as a whole. He's mad at this union for not guaranteeing him a job, which is the union's job. So this is, I don't know, his Joker moment. This is what triggers his revenge, which is how everything words it.
I don't know anything about Joker. This is a school shooter moment.
Yeah, that's the same thing.
Yeah.
Something that triggers you to do something drastic. So there's a gap. So this happens in 1959. Yeah, 1959. He doesn't seem to do anything actively to seek revenge, though, until August of 1963. In Hammond, Indiana, a signalman, Virgil Terry, went to investigate a locomotive cab that was failing to signal back. Inside the cab, or maybe nearby, he finds 60-year-old engineer Roy Batroff and 45-year-old fireman Paul Overstreet. And this is the point when I was like, why is there a fireman in here with this engineer? This is when I realized fireman's something else.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Virgil finds Roy and Paul dead at the controls, both shot in the back of the head with a .22 caliber shell, being found nearby. The police investigate, and no suspects are found. Like, they have absolutely no clue who did this. It could be anybody in the world at this point, because nobody saw anything. So no leads. At this point in time, Bladel lived in Blue Island, Illinois, and still drove a motorcycle. I don't know how far apart Hammond, Indiana and Blue Island, Illinois are.
Yeah, I have no clue.
If that was something, like, if it's a significant difference or an insignificant distance. Distance is what I wanted, not difference. Oh, well. So these are the first two deaths that are associated with him. August 1968, at the Elkhart Yard, which is the new, like, primary yard that they moved to.
Mm-hmm.
51-year-old engineer John W. Marshall of Niles, Michigan, was shot with a 12-gauge shot. Yeah, 12-gauge shotgun at close range in the abdomen, the sides, and twice in the head. So he shot minimally five times, I'm pretty sure, which is significant, because that means that guy reloaded a few times.
Jeez.
While there were witnesses, I think they were too far away to see anything specific, because all they could describe was the murderer's build, and that he had a distinct gait, which is where you get a motorcycle accident. So I assume they had to be too far away that they didn't see anything more. They still, no one knows who did this. So we get to our next one. In 1971, there's such big gaps between these.
Mm-hmm.
We have 63, 68, now 71. In Elkhart Yard, John Sane of New Buffalo, Michigan, was shot twice in the back, like the torso back, with a 357 Magnum. I don't know how to say the calipers all. That one has too many numbers for it to, like, slide off the tongue, so. But, Sane survived. Wrestled the gun from his attacker and shot the attacker in the stomach.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So, to be fair,
I feel like I would do something like that if I got shot, because I'd just be so pissed.
Because that last bit of adrenaline.
Especially with how mad I've been this week, like, it just shows the rage really does just stay in my body, and if I get pissed, I just explode on everybody, so I think, anyway, it's not a good idea to shoot me, I guess is what I'm saying.
So both John and Rudy Bladell, who was recognized by John at the hospital, by the way, go to the hospital, that's where he recognizes them, as a former co-worker, and asked him, why, Rudy? Why did you shoot me?
Yeah.
Rudy replied, to get the Niles men out of Elkhart. He was, I guess, bitter about the people that the Niles, Michigan area is where they originally were.
Yeah.
And he didn't get moved with them, I think. I think this is the issue.
Okay.
It could also be that he was one of the local guys and didn't get the job, and he's mad that they're there. I'm unsure of where he was living, because that wasn't covered well.
Something just ain't
either way, he's specifically angry at the guys from Michigan for having these jobs at the Indiana location.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's because he wanted those jobs and didn't get one, or if it's because he didn't get moved late like they did.
Yeah.
And that's the most frustrating thing, is I never get to... This is the only reasoning we ever get as to why he did any of this. So for this, he is sentenced to 1 to 5 years.
You're joking.
Yes, 1 to 5 years in Indiana.
After
State
shooting
prison,
a man in the back?
It apparently attempted murder just wasn't... Didn't get him a lot.
This ain't right.
He was released after 18 months.
Stop.
Yeah, so he served 18 months of his 1 to 5. So he served over the minimum. He should have been in there. That shouldn't have ever been the minimum. It should have been more than that, but...
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, so he was released after 18 months. April 76, so now it's been 5 years, April 76, at the Elkhart Yard again, 51-year-old engineer James M. Tiny McCrory, also from Niles, was found shot in the head with a 20-gauge deer slug while in his locomotive cab. And that's all we have for McCrory. He's dead with a deer slug. So now in 1978, Bladell is arrested by the ATF. What is that? The something,
American
something firearms. But that's like the federal regulators of certain stuff. Alcohol, something, and firearms, I think. Oh, well. Anyway, so he's arrested by the ATF after local police notify them that he, as in Bladell, had purchased a 357 Magnum in South Bend, Indiana. It is a convicted felon. That was a no-no. So that's why he gets arrested. So he serves another...
Who's still letting this man have guns?
Hmm?
I guess it was a long time ago. They didn't care back then.
How could they check
whether
or not he could have it? They ask him, are you a felon? He says no. They said, great.
Yeah, literally.
Anyway, so he's arrested and he serves another 1 to 5 year term. Which meant he served, like, 6 months, because he's released the same year. Like, this happens early in the year, he's released later in the year. So serves, like, absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
December 30th, 1978, so this is the same year he's released from prison the second time.
Okay.
Bledel books a hotel in Jackson, Michigan. With him, he had the parts of a 12-gauge shotgun in his suitcase. So the next day after he's, checked out of the hotel, he goes down to the depot, like just the local train depot, I guess. I don't know the layout of this town to know if there's more than one. He goes down there with his suitcase, assembles the gun. I don't know how no one, like, that was not witnessed by anyone. They might have thought that was weird, I would think. Anyway, so assembles a gun and heads towards the locker room where, like, the employees will be. Inside, he shoots 42-year-old flagman Robert Lee Blake of Southgate, Michigan, and 52-year-old conductor William Gulak, G-U-L-A-K, of Lincoln Park, Michigan, and turned to head back out of the locker room towards the platform when he sees 32-year-old fireman Charles Lee Burton of Jackson, Michigan, sticking his head in to investigate the gunshots he just heard. Charles is shot, killed, knocked back onto the platform. Still, somehow nobody else is there other than these people.
What the heck?
So Bledel leaves the scene, disassembles the shotgun, hides it under some bushes at Cascade Falls, which is a fountain in one of the parks in Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And then he returns to Elkhart and lived in a mission for homeless men.
Okay.
Which is now me thinking, like, he was a local who didn't get it since he's living in Elkhart. I don't know anymore.
Yeah, I don't know.
I truly don't know what... I know he has a beef, and I don't know why he has the beef. Anyway, the Jackson police are, what I would say, very competent compared to some of the stories we get.
Yeah.
They very quickly connect these murders at their depot to the other railroad murders that have been happening in Indiana and Michigan.
Over the years.
Over the years. They're like, this is a serial killer, and he's hit our town now, right? So Bledel is questioned, because he's an immediate suspect due to connections to past railroad violence. He's released due to lack of evidence, because they didn't have any witnesses. They don't have a weapon. That's true. No evidence.
Yeah.
They go, like, the whole nine yards when it comes to, like, effort. They hire scuba divers to, like, search the Grand River for, like, the gun. They have helicopters out looking on tops of the roofs of the buildings for it.
Wow.
They contact a psychic.
I love when the old police stories involve contacting psychics. That's the best. The psychics do never lead anywhere, as far as I found. That's the next thing I'm going to look up. Psychic solving a murder is what I'm going to look up next.
That's a good idea.
I'm going to type it in my search bar right now.
Anyway, none of these lead to anything. Eventually, 3 months later, later being after the murders. So 3 months after the murders. The shotgun parts are found in... by the fountain, under the bush where they were hidden.
Yeah.
And they're analyzed, and the ejection marks match the marks left on the shell casings, because they have the shell casings from the scene of the murder. So they know this is now the murder weapon. They then take the serial numbers from the parts and trace them back to Bledel, who had already been reconsidered as a suspect, because apparently the Jackson police, I don't know why he was originally a suspect, but they didn't actually know about the attempted murder charge until a little bit later.
Okay.
So he's now reintroduced to somebody who might be,
now they have more of a reason to suspect him.
Yeah. And it could be that he was just, like, in the hotel as a traveler, and that's why he was a suspect, because...
Fair enough.
That's how people choose a lot of suspects. And then this is why he's being reevaluated, is because now he was both in town knowingly and as a attempted railroad person murderer.
Yeah.
Either way, they now... want to find him, like, for sure. So March 22nd, 1979, Bledel was arrested. He initially confessed in great detail to the Jackson murders, then later recanted, saying he'd been coerced by the police.
Oh, shut up.
That he'd only been picked... This is what his story... He's like, I was coerced. My real story is that I was just in Jackson to pick up my broken motorbike... that I had only gone to the depot to wash my hands, And that he had sold the guns
Why?
Weeks before the event happened to someone in Elkhart. So it could be anybody who brought the gun up there. Evidence was enough, though, that he was sentenced to life in prison.
Yay.
Where he died in 2006 of thyroid cancer.
Oof.
Technically, he died in the hospital, but he was still, like, you know, a prisoner.
I feel like a lot of people die in prison from cancer.
Yeah. They're probably, like, doing weird things with them.
Maybe.
Exposing them to weird stuff.
Lab rats.
Not getting rid of the asbestos.
Oh, yeah. It's probably true.
Not that I think asbestos specifically causes thyroid cancer, but there's probably other things. There's probably health
issues, yeah.
But I hadn't heard of this one before. I know some people have. I know this is, like, a murder people do talk about.
That name makes sense, but I think Bladel is something that was in, like, a movie or something.
Right? Yeah, that could be.
It's also a town.
That's true.
In the Netherlands, I think it was.
Did you look it up?
Yeah, I did. But it was, like, that town and then him that came up.
Yeah, so you probably heard him. You may have heard of his
story. I don't know. I haven't heard that story.
I haven't. But I also, and it didn't come up as, like, a common podcast option, so I know it does exist out there, but...
Not in our world.
Not something I specifically have encountered.
No, that was a good one, because I haven't... I think is a good one. He's crazy, what do you mean?
So many people have, like, more reason.
No, a lot of them truly don't. Like, the AT&T building guy? Just straight up insane. True. Okay, so now it is time for my story from New York City. I got my information from, well, I guess I'll just say I'm telling the story of one if by land, two if by sea. I got my information from oneifbyland.com, paulreveereheritage.com, nyeater.com, hauntedrooms.com, paranormalstudy.com, and cntraveler.com.
I totally forgot you doing a paranormal and trying to figure out why we were talking about the crimes of Paul Revere. I'm sure he has them, but it was fascinating that you got into that.
No, but we will start with our history, and first we will start with a poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow called The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. On the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friends, if the British marched by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the North Church Tower as a signal light, one if by land and two if by sea. And I on the opposite shore will be. Ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm for the country fold to be up and to arm. Beautiful poem.
I think if you had typed that out not in one long paragraph, you could have read it better.
Well, I don't really care. I don't read poems well anyway. No, because I was reading it out whenever, like, the way that they're supposed to be written, and a lot of it didn't rhyme, and I was like, this ain't really
good. It's like there's a chunk in the middle that doesn't do anything for itself.
Yeah.
It's just the beginning and the end that are, like, a little rhymey.
Yeah. Anyway, so one if by land and two if by sea is a reference for people, which I honestly, I've heard it before, but I didn't really know what it meant, nor did I care. Is a reference to the secret signal that Paul Revere used during his ride from Boston to Concord on the verge of the Revolutionary War. The signal was meant to alert patriots about the route the British troops chose to advance to Concord. Concord. I don't know how people say that. Concord?
It's probably, depends on where you're from. I know it's like Concord, maybe it is Concord. You can say it either way.
I think I've said it both ways in my lifetime.
Yeah,
anyway.
I think it depends on the sentence.
So, when Aaron Burr was Attorney General of the state of New York during the 1790s, he housed his coach and horses in the carriage house at 17 Barrow Street. Did that say Barrow? Well, I've typed it. Yeah, I'm making sure it's not supposed to be something else. So Burr went on to become a powerful member of local and federal... Everybody that's watched Hamilton knows this man, and I refuse to watch Hamilton, and I can't be one of those people. So everybody who has seen that knows this man, but I'm just gonna say it's history.
Is it one thing Hamilton does forget? He had a whole bunch of slave children.
Who?
Burr. Like...
They also didn't talk about it in his history.
Just so everybody
knows?
Well,
because I just did a history of this place that we're covering, not about him.
No, I know, but I'm saying if everybody's seen Hamilton and you're using that as reference, we gotta get that in there.
Go ahead, because I don't know anything about this man. Nor do I truly care about him. Okay, so So he went on to become a powerful member of local and federal government, which caused him to make many enemies, particularly Alexander Hamilton. Everybody knows him. If I could stop stuttering, that'd be nice. Some of their disputes made it to, who typed this?
You.
Some of their disputes made it to print, like, yeah, in newspapers and stuff or whatever. And one of them was Hamilton saying that Burr was, quote, a dangerous man who ought not to be trusted with the reins of government. Which, that's how I feel about every politician. But Burr learned of this quote after he lost the election for governor of New York and believed that Hamilton's insults to his character are what caused him to lose the election. So, on July 11th, 1804, Burr met Hamilton in a duel on a grassy field in Weehawken, New Jersey. And Burr killed Hamilton while simultaneously killing his political career. He also lost his New York property, including the carriage house, 17 Barrow Street. Is that Barrow? Am I saying that right?
Sure.
Anyway, so there is some mystery about the house. Under the house, there is a tunnel cut in a straight line from Hudson Street, which was formerly the shore of the river. It is barrel vaulted and had the look of similar passageways of 18th century military construction. It is entirely stone-lined, brick-roofed, and appears to be constructed of the same brick and stone as the outside of the carriage house and barn and everything. So, they don't know if it was used to smuggle contraband from shore or used during the Revolutionary War. And they assume it was used during the Underground Railroad, but I guess they don't really have any proof about it.
Everybody likes to assume any tunnel was used during the Underground
Railroad. I know. So eventually, a firehouse was built next to the carriage house, and so the carriage house became an engine house. The rooms above it then housed firemen, and no longer, what does that say, livered servants?
Where are you? Liveried.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, servants used to live there, but now it's firemen living there. So at the time that this was happening, vegetable carts were banned from the street by city ordinance so that they wouldn't block the fire engines. And I just felt like adding this in here because I just thought it was funny. And hogs were banned shortly after that for health reasons during the cholera pandemics.
Those vegetable carts, they're in the way, and the hogs, they're gross.
I just felt like I thought that needs to be in there. It was funny.
Nope, that's good.
So, in the late 1800s, the city authorities sold the carriage house. The new owner quietly turned it into a house of ill repute. Then, around 1910, the property became a silent movie house.
Ooh.
It later became a bar. What kind? I don't know. I thought it was sleazy, right?
Thinking sleazy ones.
It later became a bar, a restaurant, a bar again, and then another restaurant. And then, in 1970, it was purchased by its current owners, who spent years restoring the carriage house, like, to its original old-timey glory, where they found several bits and pieces of earlier life in New York, including old coins, handmade horseshoes, and antique bottles dating to the early 1800s. The original hitching post was uncovered, which is still visible in the present bar area, which that's cool. Fun. After the restoration was complete, the building was transformed into its present form, one if by land, two if by sea. Today, it is a swanky restaurant that is recognized for its classic menu, long history, and beautiful decor. It is often cited as the most romantic restaurant in New York City. There's many an engagement that happens here, and I find that truly embarrassing.
I was truly scared that I would get engaged at a restaurant.
No, that's one of the first things I told Drew, I'm pretty sure, early on into when we were dating, that he better never embarrass me in public by proposing to me in public.
Here's the thing. That boy knew me so well that he took me to a specific secluded location on a mountain where no one else was nearby.
I know. Ours was pretty good because nobody really pays attention on that bridge. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was just a couple old people that were leaving the Indy 500 race or whatever.
That's a good enough.
Which was fine.
That's fine. That's not.
Compared to.
They're not going to make it about
making
them.
A giant scene. Yeah. The decor features candlelit tables, brick fireplaces, a baby grand piano, and a private garden. Okay, so now onto the hauntings. So, rumor has it that as many as 20 ghosts may inhabit one if by land, two if by sea. This was said by a parapsychologist who visited the restaurant. He said they were all from different time periods, but that they are all well aware of each other. So it's not like some living in a loop.
Hold on, it's like Ghost.
That's what it seems like. That's what it seems like.
They all just diving together.
Some people think that Aaron Burr and his daughter Theodosia.
Theodosia.
Either way, it's ugly. Sorry if that's your name. Haunt the establishment. That was her mother's name, too. Doesn't mean you should keep it. Anyway, so the daughter's name that I won't repeat was said to have been kidnapped by pirates while on her way to New York from South Carolina to visit her father. I don't know if that's true at all. I just thought in a source and said, well, it sounds kind of interesting. Let's throw it in. Yeah.
Yeah.
She was said to have been forced to walk the plank, but her death did not stop her from going back to her father's residence, allegedly. Let's see. There are also stories about other spirits, one being a woman who is wearing a black dress and has been seen walking down the staircase, but never up, and apparently the story that everybody has given her is that she broke her neck falling down the stairs. So that's why they never see her going up and down.
So she's stuck in a loop. She's just always going down.
Apparently. There's also a spirit who mostly sticks to the office. A psychic claims to have encountered it. I'm not sure what he does. I guess just hangs out in the office. Because there's no more about him anywhere else.
Just goes to the office. That's all we know.
that's it. There's another spirit who is thought to be a Ziegfeld Follies girl. Do you know what that is?
I'm and the staff light candles for her. Some kind of dancer.
Yeah, I don't know. Exotic type?
Of the exotic type. Based on the past of the building.
Yeah. Another spirit is said to be that of a man who likes to linger around the fireplace, often greeting guests with a warm smile and a friendly nod before he fades away. And I think that's very sweet.
Yeah.
And then there's another one who likes to use the front door. So I'm assuming it's just a really annoying one who opens and closes the front door and makes the staff think someone's coming in. Mm-hmm. Because that would really annoy me if I was a worker. On several occasions, patrons have complained of a table full of rowdy, drunken men. When management approaches the table, the group of men abruptly vanish, leaving behind a table covered in spilled alcohol. I like that one the most, I think.
That's good.
One article I read from 2011 had some quotes from staff, so I'm not really sure if they work there anymore, but the general manager at the time, Roseanne Martino, said, quote, "I had experiences." Yeah.
That's an example of Ezekiel's Follies.
I had experiences. Or I've had experiences. Inexplainable. Inexplicable experiences? I've been here for 8 years and I have seen a lot. She said she had experienced things like picture frames tilting, which I guess like in front of her and not just like finding it tilted. Machinery activating itself. Strange drafts, especially by the bar, flying plates, flickering lights, staff members occasionally being pushed, and then they turn around and there's no one there, so like, not like, shoved. Plates and silverware have been known to raise off of shelves in front, in like full view of people, and sometimes they will even float around the room.
I would love to see that.
It would be like Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
She said that waiters have attempted to serve guests who are sitting at a table, but they turn out to just be spirits. Which I like that one, that mm-hmm. they seem so real that you're literally going to go take their order.
You'd be a little bit frustrated though that you're not getting a tip now.
Oh, I would. Then another then-manager, Kirk Adair, described the restaurant like a forest. I don't understand this, but I added it in. You know there are creatures around you, but you don't necessarily see them. Maybe out of the corner of your eye. But for the most part, they stay hidden.
I get that.
Many staff members have quit over the years due to their experiences, but no one thinks these spirits are malicious, although one of the restaurant's maitre d's quit after she was shoved up and down the stairs nightly by unseen hands. For the most part, they seem to like to play practical jokes. Once, for a good period of time, night after night, women kept losing their earrings at the bar, and there was no explanation for it.
That's really weird.
And that is the end of One If By Land, Two If By Sea in New York City.
What's the connection to Paul Revere?
Just the name of the restaurant.
Literally just the name of the restaurant. Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. I thought I was going crazy.
Nope.
And I, like, missed, like, one key thing. And this is where Aaron Burr and Paul Revere once had beers. Nope. Like, that's all I could think. But I was like, I don't really know if they were in the same circles.
No, just the name of the restaurant. Which I thought I should just include it because otherwise you're like, why is that the name of the restaurant?
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
And that's all I have for you today. Well, for that story. Anyway.
Yes?
I guess try not to kill anybody and don't mess with Ouija boards.
Bye.
Goodbye.